And good afternoon. You're listening to KTOO News in Juneau. My name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host this afternoon on a Juneau afternoon. We got an interesting show coming your way. First, we're going to be learning about this weekend's great backyard bird count with our guest Brenda Wright. And then we're going to be learning about Aleutian terns. Dr. Sanjay Piare from University of Alaska Southeast will be in the studio. And then we're going to hear from Mike Viseth, who is this Wednesday's Juneau World Affairs Council speaker. He's going to be talking about the curse of the blue nun and the miracle of the two-buck chuck. We're talking about wine, folks. That and more coming up.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tuesday night's anti-racism rally in Rapid City, South Dakota, came in the wake of an alleged hate crime against a group of Native American students during a hockey game in January. The rally was one effort to improve race relations in the city. Charles Michael Ray reports.
The rally included a list of speakers, along with some traditional Lakota songs, and a crowd of people, many who say they traveled long distances to attend, and many who expressed sadness and anger at the alleged hate crime against Native students during a January hockey game. Helen Redfeather is a Lakota elder who huddled against the cold under a red and black blanket.
And I came because I'm a Lakota. I'm from Wounded Knee. And ever since I can remember coming up here, it was prejudice. It's time these KKKs need to go back to where they came from, too, and get out of our town and take the racism with them, too. That's why I'm here, because I'm sticking out, standing up for my grandkids that are small and that can't be here.
Rally organizers say this event needs to be part of an ongoing cross-cultural communication that can start to deal with race relations here. Those like former South Dakota State Senator Tom Kadis agree.
We white folks especially have to step up and call it like it is. Even this rally tonight, it's about 90% Native. Where in the hell are my white neighbors? Where's West Boulevard? Where's West Rapid? What do we have to do? Have the city burned down before people start paying attention?
The Rapid City mayor was one of those in attendance. Sam Quaker says racism is an issue that must be addressed.
It's important to be here because as a community, we cannot tolerate racism. It will be an ongoing struggle until the end of time to end it, but that doesn't mean we should stop struggling.
Rapid City police officials say the investigation into the alleged assault on Native students at the hockey game is ongoing. They're asking for community patience and promise an outcome soon. Rally organizers are now calling for a community meeting and a march at the end of the month. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
A tribal health corporation in Alaska is looking to build a new $250 million facility in Bethel to help meet the needs of a growing population. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation needs more space. That's true overall and for individual patient rooms. On a recent tour, President and CEO Dan Winkleman explains how hospital rooms would grow and be updated in the proposed expansion.
So we're actually in an existing inpatient room right now, and it's just over 100 square feet, and new rooms are over a couple hundred square feet, so double the size of this. And as you can see, this is a pretty tight room. This was built to 1980 standards, and the standards have increased since then significantly.
The expansion would more than double the number of beds in the ER and prepare the Tribal Health Corporation for projected growth in the YK Delta. That's from about 23,000 Alaska Native health beneficiaries to 30,000 by 2025. YKHC recently scored best in the nation in their proposal to the Indian Health Services Joint Venture Construction Program. If they advance, IHS would provide staffing and operation funds when new facilities are built. Winkleman says the building would help transform the patient experience and reflect the region's cultures.
It is extremely important for me that our patients, when they come into a facility, that they feel welcomed.
The expansion could provide 200 additional staff to join, freeing up providers to visit patients at the region's many small clinics in remote communities. Before any shovel meets dirt, Winkleman says the project has to complete an agreement with IHS and clear many logistic challenges to finance and prepare for a new facility. I'm Ben Matheson in Bethel, Alaska.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the Tribal Telecom May 4th, weaving pathways across the digital divide. Information on services and Tribal Telecom 2015 at ahcnm.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Okay, welcome to a Juneau afternoon, and our first guest in the studio this afternoon is Brenda Wright, affiliated with the Juneau Audubon Society, here to talk about the Great Backyard Bird Count, which is happening this weekend. It's Friday through Sunday. And why don't you tell us what the Great Backyard Bird Count is?
Yeah, thanks for allowing me to have some time here. This is a great citizen science project. It happens all over North America, and in just the last few years, it's become global. And it's a time in the winter when you can help science by looking at the birds in your neighborhood and telling the people what kinds are there and how many. It's a really easy thing to do, and it's not just in your backyard. Just even though that's in the name, it can be anywhere outside. As long as you look for about at least 15 minutes and you have an email address, you can join in this project.
So what are people asked to do? What are they supposed to do, whether it's from their backyard or out on a trail or in the wetlands or wherever?
Uh-huh. It really is pretty simple. You just have to note down the time and then note down how many birds you saw and what types they were. And if you're at an actual bird feeder, please try not to count the same bird 14 times, just because it comes and goes in 15 minutes 14 times. And make your best estimate if you see a large flock. You know, we can't, if you see one of the pine siskin flocks that are milling around all over Juneau right now, there might be 1,000 or there might be 30. So just take a best guess, and then you can always tell them that's an estimate.
So, and then what? At the end of the bird count, volunteers do this, they collect this information, and then what do they do with the information?
Yeah, that's a great question. This time of year is actually a very, very harsh time for birds. There's little food, and they might be moving around because there's little food, or there might be plentiful food, so lots of birds in one place and not in another. And scientists can use this data to see trends over time, which means that you can see whether this particular species is overwintering well, if the species is increasing, it's decreasing, and that helps scientists understand more about the lives of birds in winter. So I would like to say that it's just as easy as 1, 2, 3, okay? All you have to do is go outside, look around, count the birds, and then you can enter your data online. So it's very, very simple. You just go to www.birdcount.org, and they'll give you all the instructions you need. They'll give you identification guides. They'll help you understand what we mean by citizen science. They'll give you a free app that you can put on your smartphone or iPod or iTouch and help you identify birds you don't know. And it's all 700 of the local birds in North America, so they should pop right up. It's a great app. It's really fun to use with kids.
So this will take place in Juneau, and I'm assuming elsewhere.
Yes, it's all over the world. And in North America,
on the same day?
On the same day, starting this Friday on the 13th and going through Monday the 16th. And you can do it at night, too. If you hear an owl and you can identify that owl, you can certainly count it.
So worldwide, scientists are working with citizens,
mm-hmm.
and this is the winter count. Do you do this in the summer and different seasons, or is it always in the wintertime?
Yeah, this actually only started about 30 years ago, this particular count. We have a Christmas bird count. I think maybe other people might be aware of that. It started over 100 years ago, and they started counting birds instead of shooting them on Christmas Day. And that's been going on for a very long time, and it's been very, very helpful to scientists. And so recently they when they started an electronic version of checklists, which is called eBird, they decided that it would be wonderful to have another winter count. It would be very, very helpful to help with the trends in birds. We're losing quite a few birds because of unknown reasons, I mean, whether they're, it's their winter habitat or their summer habitat or the travel in between. We just don't know. So it's just more information to help scientists.
So Juneau's a very outdoor and recreation-minded community. I'm curious, the Juneau level of participation in the bird count, is it strong? Is it?
You know, that's exactly why I'm here, because I'm trying to get our checklist up to over 40. You can submit more than one checklist. If you happen to, you know, go outside in your yard, if you go down to the beach, if you go up skiing and you see a ptarmigan, those would be three different checklists. That's three different habitats. Different places. Or you can stay in one place all day looking out your office window. You're not allowed to do that, you know. But you can look out your office window and see if, yeah, they're coming to the feeder. Yeah, they're coming to the feeder. And so you might have been looking out there once or twice every hour, but that all adds up to 30 minutes over the day, and you write down that, and now you have another checklist.
And on occasion, is a rare bird spotted here in the Juneau area?
Yeah, you wouldn't believe this, but on our Christmas bird count this year, last December, on December 14th, we saw one of the rarest birds seen in Juneau, and it was on the count day of Christmas bird count. It was a long-eared owl, and two of the best birders in town saw it and took pictures. So it was really, really a wonderful event. It's only the third time a owl like that's been seen in Alaska in winter.
And I'm assuming over the years, are there different species that get seen? I mean, there's the kind of traditional birds that are in the area and you might expect to see, but I would think maybe, are there new birds showing up or birds no longer being seen that you're aware of?
Yeah, that this is a really strange year for us. Usually we see over 1,000 scoters, different types of surf scoters.
Yeah.
And there's very, very few this year. And right now, just over there in Douglas, near the boat harbor, but not at the boat harbor, is a king eider that doesn't live anywhere near here in winter.
Mm-hmm.
But it's shown up in town. And right at Auk Rec, there's several dozen varied thrushes that we love to listen to all summer but don't live here in the winter. Why they came back, maybe they know that there's no snow at Eagle Crest. I don't know.
So for you're looking to have, you know, more people participate. So
yes.
For a potential first-time participant, you know, what words of encouragement would you give them about, you know, packing up for the day or spending part of the day out doing this?
It's a really fun thing to do. And you can do it for 15 minutes or you can do it for 5 hours if you're cross-country skiing. It's a really easy thing to do. Just remember to go to the web page. They'll give you lots of hints, lots of interesting, answer all your questions. And it's just birdcount.org, or look in Google it for a great backyard bird count.
Well, great. We've been speaking with Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society, and she's here on behalf of the Great Backyard Bird Count, which is occurring this Friday through Monday. Here in Juneau and all over the world. People will be doing this. Brenda, anything else you wanted to make sure that you conveyed to the audience before you leave?
Just dress for the weather if you go outside.
Well, hopefully in the second half of the bird watching window here, the weather will improve, but a little bit wet on the first couple of days, perhaps.
Well, the ducks don't mind, and we don't either.
That's right. The birds are out in it, so we can be out in it, too. Brenda, thank you very much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you.
Song. When the red robin, the red, red rabbit comes bow, bow, bowing along.
And up next on a Juno Afternoon, interesting topic here, or the title of the presentation is called Global Surf Addicts, A Journey from Yakutat to Sumatra and Papua New Guinea with the Aleutian Terns. This is a presentation that Dr. Sanjay Piare, an associate professor at UAS here in Juneau, will be giving tomorrow night at Centennial Hall in the Egan Room. I'm not sure what time. Do you guys know?
It's 7 p.m.
7 p.m. tomorrow night, Centennial Hall, Egan Room. And I, before we get started, let me think, what was I going to ask? And then Mike Goldstein is also here in the studio. And Mike, you're a partner with Sanjay here on this study, is that correct?
That's right, with the Forest Service.
All right. So Sanjay, tell us, I mean, what is this? What's this presentation going to be all about? I realize that Aleutian Terns are the subject matter, but tell us about it.
Yeah. So, the title is a little bit of a riff on sort of a personal surf addiction, but that's kind of why
I asked. I thought there might be a connection.
But there's an interesting, as we pursued the story, there's an interesting story behind where this bird is going that we didn't really expect. And the story goes back to 2006 when Mike actually brought together a group to really flesh out a few anecdotes about why this bird in a few places is disappearing. For instance, in Cordova, in Kodiak, and a few other places, there have been more than anecdotal declines of large colonies of this species in Alaska in the numbers of thousands, no longer breeding there. And so that was an initial basis to get together an interagency group. The Fish and Game as well was there, Fish and Wildlife Service, and we initiated a project at that point. Really, it was quite basic. It was how many and where are they going? And those are kind of two questions, that we sort of tried to pursue from 2006. That basically, the president was still working on this.
And so, what have you found out so far?
The more we know, the less we know. That's with all of these things. What we found out is, one thing we found out is the bird is the uncertainty about what exactly is going on with this bird is really because this bird does very uncertain things. It's the more we look at it, the more we realize it's more of a nomadic, what's known as a nomadic species. It's not really tied to specific areas and doesn't tend to go in just one location, even in terms of its wintering ground. And I'll talk a little about this tomorrow night in terms of the diversity of areas in terms of where it shows up. So we found that on one hand, the bird is a huge challenge. Mike and I are actually trained really as conservation biologists, and so in that light, making recommendations about conservation and what's happening with this Alaskan bird is challenging. So,
Aleutian tern is different than Arctic tern.
That's right. Arctic terns, at least those that have been studied on migration, are heading down on either side of North America, down towards Antarctica, maybe flipping over the mountains in southern Chile, Argentina, and intermixing down there in a really big area. Aleutian terns nest pretty much from Glacier Bay and then out across Alaska and into parts of Russia, Kamchatka, Sakhalin Island, and such. Well, those birds that we've studied from Yakutat migrated across the Aleutians over to Russia, down through Japan, and that's where the four birds that we recovered split and went to different locations. Really amazing uncertainty as to what we know, but what we know is that the span of these birds is across 4,000 miles in their non-breeding areas, in their wintering areas.
So how are you tracking them? How are you?
That's a good question. So So there's lots of, you know, ways these days with technology to track, but it turns out we relied on a very old technology, and that is light. We're using a device called a geolocator, which reads ambient levels of light. Reads two things. It basically reads day length and where or what time of day the sun actually peaks. And so you can piece those two things together to get two things called latitude and longitude within some degree of accuracy. It's not a great way to do it, but at the scale of the entire globe, it's a pretty nice way to figure out location. So we attached 113 of these back in 2010.
In Yakutat, one place. Yeah.
And we since have slowly recovered about an average of about one per year going back. So it's been slow going. One of the things we learned is that some of these birds may not be going back to the same place. So that's one of the challenges.
Or they might skip a year before they come back.
But you've managed to place them in Sumatra and Papua New Guinea and
the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And we are...
And is that you from here identifying their location? I mean, through this technology, is that the way it works?
This technology is pretty amazing, but one of the challenges is that you have to actually recover the unit. So you have to recapture the bird, get the unit off.
And you've recaptured them here in Alaska, or did you have people in Papua New Guinea saying, got this bird with this thing on it? And
wouldn't that be wonderful?
We wish it was Papua New Guinea, but
it's the recoveries back in the Yakutat area with our great partners that we work with.
So how did this project come to pass? What was the initial motivation, inspiration to take on this task?
It was really just a total lack of information. You sort of look at, there's ornithologists everywhere and they love to write up things about, there's all sorts of specialists. And this bird was interesting. Like, it was basically a complete black box when we started in terms of where this bird was spending 10 months out of the year. Other than it bred in Alaska and Siberia, so that was really the one of the motivations, is really to fill in some of this picture in terms of where this bird is overwintering.
I mean, there's not a lot of times in your career you get to say you're picking up something brand new to science, and that's, I mean, for the conservation and management of this species, we knew that that's where we had to go, and. It's pretty interesting because just the anecdotal information that's been out there is it's spotty at best, from people not identifying the bird correctly per se, or they're just not being people out there. They're actually looking for and or reporting on birds down in that area. So we do hope, that we have an opportunity to go down in the near future and establish better rapport, with colleagues and collaborators down there, more than the phone calls and emails and other work that we've done just to try and get people on the ground in different places.
So I imagine a project like this, is there an end to this such a body of research? I mean, do you have a sense of how many years it would take to come up with some kind of definitive statement, or is it just ongoing?
there's an anecdote here, right? Because we sort of, 2010, 2011, we got one, 2012, we got one. 2013, we kind of gave up, thinking, well, we're not really sure. But 2014, lo and behold, 4 years later, we caught two birds, and they were completely sort of accidental, in terms of how we did it. And so I would say Mike and I are pretty interested in doubling down and making this really, we want to, the way to approach this is long-term. Really, yeah. if we're going to have some success in piecing a story together, so
and that's part of it, the winter, the non-breeding sites, what's actually going on there is fantastic. Right. It's tremendous, but there's a lot of other stuff that's going on across the state of Alaska, with a lot of uncertainty as well. Are these colonies do they normally blink out over the course of several years and just move some distance away, 50 kilometers away, where nobody's looking for them?
Yeah.
Or is there some larger problem with forage fish or some other perturbation on the nesting grounds. We're fortunate that the area we've been working at and the place where the Forest Service manages in Black Sand Spit in Yakutat, that colony's persisted since, well, it was first written up around 1914. So we're hopeful that this type of colony can give us some insights, greater insights into some of the nesting behaviors, which might allow us to understand better why the species might be blinking in or blinking out across other parts of the state.
So for people who come to your presentation tomorrow night, well, I mean, are you going to have slides? Is there going to be give people a sense of what they're going to get?
Yeah, they're going to do a tour of surf sites too. And
so Mike, yeah. Are you a surfer too? Because clearly Sanjay is.
It's clearly Sanjay. I've tried a little bit. you need one real ornithologist in the mix.
We're going to do a little technology too. We're going to bring we'll probably bring some of the geolocators as well, and
people can put their hands on them.
And we'll maybe go to school. We're going to do a little exercise on latitude and longitude and I think telling how to tell your location using light levels. I think I was thinking that would be kind of a fun thing to do. So,
mm-hmm. But yeah. I don't know if you're going to get to this, Sanjay, but one of the great places for folks to see these Aleutian terns is in Yakutat, right. And the Yakutat Ranger District of the Forest Service has a tern festival each year.
And
I think
right.
It's going to be like the fifth year this year. And it's pretty fun. It's designed, you know, for adult field trips, and it's designed for a lot of kids' education activities. And the folks up there, Susan Ohlers and the rest, have been doing such a phenomenal job. You know, it's my hopes that we get, you know, more and more kids out of Juneau up there to take a look at what it's like, not only in Yakutat or some great surf spot, but to take a look at these seabirds in the area where they're nesting.
So where in Yakutat? I mean, I'm assuming most people haven't. They've maybe landed in Yakutat, but do they know the area? Are you out on the outer coast, or are you inland a little bit up in one of the fjord areas? Or?
It's amazing because the tours, kid tours and adult tours, go both out pelagic on the water, across the bay, mm-hmm. out to the spit, the Black Sand Spit, and a few other locations inland as well. So you get the full gamut if you go.
Mm-hmm.
It's nearby, and I'd love to see greater participation coming out of Juneau for it.
It's May 28th to the 31st,
That's
and there's
right.
usually a ferry they schedule specifically to go up to that, from if I recall.
Yeah, I've been hearing about this in recent years, so it sounds like it's a growing event, which is great.
A growing event, that's correct.
So, Sanjay, I'm not going to ask you really about the surf piece, because I think you need to hold that for people who turn out for your presentation so they
right.
can learn more about the surf part of all of this. But so before we wrap up, anything else that you guys really wanted to make sure you told the community here in terms of your presentation tomorrow night?
No, I think Mike really mentioned the Yakutat Tern Festival would be a great place to kind of learn more. There's going to be presentations about terns and whatnot as well, and field trips actually out to Black Sand Spit. So if you're really interested in this, come on out. It's not that hard to get to Yakutat, actually. So.
Yeah, and if folks can't make it tomorrow night for whatever reason, lo and behold, we're available if folks would like to contact us.
Aleutian Terns is the subject matter tomorrow night, Centennial Hall, Egan Room, 7:00?
7:00.
7:00. Mike Goldstein, Sanjay Piare, thank you very much, both of you, for coming in this afternoon.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Storks. And babies. Have been linked together for centuries. But how did that old legend get started that storks bring babies? Researchers suggest that the legend goes back into pagan times, when civilizations were keen to have high birth rates. It probably began in what is now northern Germany. The legend concerns the white stork, a large, stately bird with black wings and red legs and bill. These birds breed in Europe, but migrate far to the south to winter in tropical Africa, the link between storks and babies was forged by the birds' return in spring, a time when many babies were born, just about 9 months after midsummer. The association with babies has been propitious for the storks. People encouraged the birds to build their large stick nests on roofs and chimneys. Even today, many people associate storks with good luck and look forward to the birds' return each spring. Discover a bundle of information on these birds and others when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann. I'm going to see if I can get this stork to put that baby down.
Okay, up next on a Juno afternoon, a fascinating topic and guest. We have Mike Viseth in the studio along with Jim Clark and from the World Affairs Council. And the topic for tonight's presentation right here in KTOO downstairs at 360 Studio at 5 p.m., the topic is called The Curse of the Blue Nun and the Miracle of Two Buck Chuck. And we're talking about wine, correct?
I think so.
You hope so. So, Mike, you're a wine economist.
That's right.
Why don't you tell people what a wine economist is?
Well, if I said I was a housing economist, you'd know I studied housing and housing starts and all the factors in the building industry. And if I said I was a labor economist, you'd know I did wages. And so it turns out that, and this came as a surprise to me at the start, that wine isn't just an art and a science and alcohol and a beverage and everything. It's a big business around the world. Not as big a business here in Alaska in terms of making the wine, but I think a pretty big business in terms of selling it. And so I'm a specialist in globalization. I study the global wine markets, and I travel the world talking to wine industry groups about how the global markets are changing and how it's affecting the business environment that they face, which then affects what is actually in your glass when you open a bottle of wine.
It's way more complicated than I thought.
Well, that's good.
So tonight, then, without giving too much away about the presentation and what have you, the title just fascinates me, The Curse of the Blue Nun and the Miracle of Two Buck Chuck. So can you just give a hint about what that dynamic or what that story
is? These are two important forces that have shaped and are shaping the world of wine. Have you ever had Blue Nun wine?
I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, it's a generational thing.
Yeah.
I find that people, Jim, in my age, when I say, "Have you ever had Blue Nun?" They all, it's as if they're confessing. Oh my God, Professor, I had Blue Nun and I had Matus Rosé and I had Annie Green Springs. And forgive me because I have sinned against wine to do this. And when I with millennials, with college age students, they. I have to explain that it's kind of like yellowtail or maybe barefoot wine or something like that. But anyway, Blue Nun was arguably the world's first mass market wine brand. There was a time when Blue Nun wine, which comes from Germany, Blue Nun wine was the best-selling imported wine in the United States and one of the best-selling wine brands in the world. And so the curse of the Blue Nun is how Blue Nun's successful marketing and quality, but how Blue Nun became this global phenomenon, and then how it collapsed to the point where you've heard of it, but you've never really tried it. So the curse of the Blue Nun is sometimes the factors that make you can break you, and you have to learn from that. The miracle of Two Buck Chuck. Now, have you ever had Two Buck
Chuck?
Is this
the generational piece here?
Well, have you ever had Two Buck Chuck?
I haven't.
Yeah, all right. So do you know what it is?
I've heard of it.
All right. Two Buck Chuck is this wine that is sold by Trader Joe's stores.
Yeah.
And they sell about...
Which we don't have here.
They don't have in Alaska, although people will have heard of it.
Yeah.
They sell about 5 million cases of it a year. They've made more than 200 million cases of this wine called... it's technically Charles Shaw wine, but that Charles... In California, it originally sold for $1.99 a bottle, and so they called it Two Buck Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
It's made by the Bronco Wine Company, which is owned by Fred Franzia, and it's an inexpensive wine. And it became a phenomenon within the wine culture. It is very controversial because it's kind of a very simple wine. And so snobs say, well, this is debasing wine, and that's it's not really wine and so forth. But I think it democratized wine. And so the miracle of Two Buck Chuck, which I will explain what the miracle is at 5 o'clock. The miracle of Two Buck Chuck is that Americans who are so hung up on price as an indicator of quality and status and everything, Americans who are afraid to spend $2, $3, $4 on wine because they think people will look down their nose. Americans bought this thing up. It was a miracle. It was a miracle that they were able to get people to buy an inexpensive wine that was actually quite good. And that this has, it was instrumental, I will argue, in the growth of wine in the United States to the point where today the U.S. is the largest wine market in the world, bigger than France, bigger than Italy, bigger than Spain.
Most people probably didn't know that.
No. And so isn't that a miracle?
For wine enthusiasts, absolutely.
Sure. Why not?
So actually, I want to get back to you in just a moment. But Jim, I'm curious, from the Juneau World Affairs Council perspective, I know you get lots of interesting people to come to the capital city to speak. What was it about a wine economist that appealed to you when you were thinking about a presentation?
First off, I'm a big wine lover, and I think a number of the members of the Juneau World Affairs Council are, and we had the opportunity to have Mike come. We cooperate on speakers with the Anchorage World Affairs Council, and we talked it over and thought this would be a tremendous opportunity. Plus, Mike had been here before, and some of our board members knew of him and said he gives a terrific talk, and I'm looking forward to it tonight. I didn't hear it in 2008, but I'm looking forward to hearing it tonight.
Mike, have you been to Anchorage already?
No, that's my next stop. I'm actually doing a wine dinner for the World Affairs Council there, and then I'll give a talk.
But not here in Juneau,
well, no,
Jim?
It was a scheduling matter.
But we just had the WorldQuest event on Friday night, and notwithstanding our fantastic organizational ability, I figured trying to put on two big events like that back-to-back was a little more than we could handle.
No, the wine dinner will have to be the next trip.
So there was a phrase that came with some of the information about your presentation, and I'm just going to read the quote here. The wine wars that have redrawn the world wine map and changed what's in your wine glass. The wine wars that have redrawn the
Absolutely,
map.
Absolutely, yeah.
Can you speak briefly to that?
Sure. It's the third piece. In order to keep the title so it will fit on a banner or something, it's The Curse of the Blue Nun, The Miracle of Two Buck Chuck. And The Miracle of Two Buck Chuck is partly about simplifying the messaging of wine so that people can understand it and can embrace it, because wine can be very intimidating. You know, wine, I sent some of my students to a local grocery store, just the normal supermarket, not a fancy place. And they came back and they said that they found over 800 different wines ranging from about $2 per bottle equivalent. It was a 5-liter box of Franzia to over $300. Now, that's a tremendous range. That's a huge number of products, and that's a tremendous range in price for what is essentially fermented grape juice, after all. So it's very intimidating for all of this. So part of what happens is that in order to make it approachable, you begin to simplify it. But there's the risk that you can simplify too much. And so the sort of the commercialization element of it is one side of the war. And then the people who I call in the book title terroirists. Terroir is a French word for a sense of place. And so terroirists are people who care about place, who do fork to table. They look for authenticity, for local products. And wine is caught in this battle between the people, the commercialization, and the people who are trying desperately to keep wine as a special thing as well.
You have you're a very successful author, national best-selling books on wine. You have a blog that I understand to be one of the renowned ones when it comes to wine and discussion of wine, the economy of wine. How did this start? How long have you been doing this?
Oh, I've been working very diligently at it for about 10 years. But the original, as I was telling Jim earlier, is about 30 years ago, I was sampling wine in Napa Valley, and not very knowledgeably, and the winemaker found out that I was an economist and began to pepper me with questions. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, he's taught me that wine is a business, and that the same ideas that I use to study and talk about other businesses, other parts of the economy, those same tools can be used in dealing with wine. And the blog, wineeconomist.com, there is no subscription and everything. The wineeconomist.com started off because I wanted to communicate not just to other professors or other scholars, but I wanted to get consumers and knowledgeable amateurs and industry people to give me feedback. And it's been tremendously successful in terms of using social media as a tool of research and connection. And it has been a very fulfilling journey.
So the presentation this evening at 5 o'clock is there a slideshow? I mean, what give people a sense of?
I have a PowerPoint, but it's not a PowerPoint full of charts and graphs and three bullet points. It's to illustrate it the way you would with a slideshow. Jim, we don't have any wine, do we?
Well, we might cure that between now and then.
All right,
that's the question that's hanging out there.
Is that where you were going with
well,
it?
Well, I was curious, you know. We got just a couple of minutes here. Jim, was there anything else about the World Affairs Council that you wanted to make sure people knew about or about tonight's?
Well, usually I just point out that the Juneau World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, to purpose of which is to do what we're doing with Mike, and that is to bring in really interesting speakers on topics of international significance, and wine is certainly a topic of international significance, and so we're delighted to have him. And as you said, it's at 5 o'clock in the KTOO studios this evening. We're hoping we'll get a bunch of folks to come and hear Mike.
So, Mike, last question. Is wine good for you?
It's in moderation, it's good for you, I think. Wine is good. In moderation, wine can be good for you, but it's like everything else in life.
Well, I have a lot of other questions that I'll have to come tonight to ask those. I'm assuming there'll be some question and answer opportunities.
Yes, I would imagine. People usually have questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, including with the Terroir East connection. I once had a person came, he read it as terrorist. And it was a very interesting question about wine and terrorism. So
tonight's presentation from Mike Veseth, the wine economist, with the Juneau World Affairs Council, this evening at 5 o'clock right here at 360 in the studios downstairs here at the KTOO building. Jim, good to see you. Mike, pleasure to meet you, and I hope you have a great turnout tonight.
Thank you very much.
This broadcast, made possible by Alaska Communications, offering broadband and wireless solutions designed to help small businesses. Because Alaska Communications believes that small businesses deserve to have the same tools as big businesses. AlaskaCommunications.com.
And we have a special feature here on a Juneau afternoon this afternoon. National Public Radio's Tiny Desk Concert Series has become anything but tiny since its inception in 2008. And this year, the series began a contest open to all where the winner gets to travel to NPR in Washington, D.C. and play a concert at the Tiny Desk. In this inaugural year, the contest received over 7,000 entries, including 17 from Alaska. KTOO Scott Burton caught up with All Songs Considered host Bob Boylan and Alaska artist and contest participant Marion Call and brings us this story.
Playing a Tiny Desk concert at NPR is a big deal. Cat Stevens, Jackson Browne, and Lucinda Williams are among the names who have performed in front of the book, CD, and record shelves at the All Songs Considered office.
Something work at this way comes. The likes of work you never known. He'll buy.
All Songs Considered host Bob Boylan and Stephen Thompson conceived of the Tiny Desk concert after leaving a bar show, frustrated they couldn't hear the music over the crowd noise. Here's Boylan introducing the first ever Tiny Desk concert in 2008.
So we're going to videotape this for
our blog, and maybe it's the start of something, and maybe it's not, but we're certainly glad to have Laura Gibson here today. Thank you for doing it.
Up with sunrise, you'll be staring out through the window on the day.
Almost 7 years later, the series has over 400 performance videos on its website. Boylan had no idea.
I never really thought that it would go much beyond a little novelty thing that we did now and again.
The name Tiny Desk Concert is a double entendre that references Boylan's old psychedelic band, the Tiny Desk Unit, and that artists literally play at his desk. He says the series was a success from that first video.
The series spoke to people. The moment we put Laura Gibson online in a video form, the reaction we got to that very video, because of its intimacy, connected on a level I didn't really expect.
You'll be the first to spin your story. I'll be the last to let you go. Tell me you're all.
Fast forward 7 years through concerts by Pat Benatar, T-Pain, Trey Anastasio, Nickel Creek, Nico Case, Lyle Lovett, Wilco, Steve Earle, and hundreds more, and add a twist.
Yes, there's a contest, and wonderful, there's going to be a winner, but the most important wonderful thing is for people and friends to get together and make something. That is, you know, that's the value of art, it's the value of community, and so that's what we wanted to inspire.
Juneau-based musician Marion Call, who also happens to be a KRNN DJ, couldn't agree more. Call, the Woolpullers, who we're listening to now, and George Kuhar performed at a house concert in Juneau where three video entries were recorded for the contest.
I'm anti-contest in general, but I felt like this one both had a good prize, a good mechanism, and was good for everyone, even in the entering. You know, it wasn't exclusive, it wasn't dangling money, it wasn't dangling a record contract, it was just about, you know, performing in a venue that all of us have always wanted to perform in, right? But then, even better than that, they gave us an excuse to create our own space that felt like a Tiny Desk concert and claim it, you know? So now 5,000 people have claimed a little stake of their own Tiny Desk world, and I think that's exactly the best possible outcome. More art was born.
A sleep mute and Anchorage-based musician named Emma Hill also made some new art.
One of the very first videos I watched was a woman named Emma Hill, and she did a song about Denali. She did a song just dedicated to her home, you know, and the thing that she loves, and it's a beautiful song. She did with a banjo player who had the most fantastic-looking banjo. It was like this refraction paper, psychedelic-looking banjo. They both sat on little tiny chairs but next to a little tiny table, and it was delightful. I loved it.
Boylan will announce the winner on NPR's Morning Edition tomorrow. He says the choice was difficult and meant a lot of long nights at the Tiny Desk reviewing videos. Ultimately, he says the winner's talent and charisma is undeniable. But who really cares about winners? It's about the creation of new art, right? In Juneau, I'm Scott Burton.
And a big thank you to Scott Burton for that piece. Also, to watch each of the 17 video entries from Alaska, please visit our website at ktoo.org. And then just a quick note, KTOO's Annie Bartholomew, who's done an internship program here and has done some work here, is currently an intern at NPR, an internship that was actually very highly competitive on a nationwide basis, and she secured the internship. And one of the things that she's working on is the Tiny Desk Concert. And when Annie returns to Juneau in the spring, she will actually be joining the staff here at KTOO as an arts and culture producer. Okay, Eagle Crest weather, looking out the window, all this promising snow this last week, and then it kind of warmed up, and we have Jeffra Clough here to tell us, give us an update. Eagle Crest.
Well, the good news is Mother Nature has looked a little favorably on us. She gave us some new snow. We got about 9 inches at the top of the mountain, about 6.5 inches at the Day Lodge. But prior to that snow, we did get quite a bit of pretty good cold snap allowed us to make quite a bit of snow. So we're lucky we're able to make enough snow to reopen the Porcupine Chair on Saturday.
Yay!
So, you know, it's small steps.
Tough year.
We're going for the small wins this year. But the chairlift will be open from 9 until 4, weekends and holidays, until Mother Nature sees fit to give us some more snow so we can get the rest of the mountain open. But we're excited to have that Porcupine Chair open. We're also going to restart our Wee Ski and our Little Rippers programs. So those are our 3 to 6-year-old programs. And we also have snow sports school instructors on staff. And so I think people might go, oh, man, I was going to learn how to ski and snowboard this year. Now all this stuff, they're open, they're closed, I don't know what's going on. Let me tell you, it's the skiing and snowboarding on Porcupine is going to be really good. So if this was your year to learn how to ski or snowboard, don't give up. Come on up. You can give us a call at 790-2000 extension 211 or check out our website at skijuno.com. And don't give up on your goal to learn how to ski or snowboard this winter, because we can make it happen.
Well, I know there's no way to really predict, but hopefully the snow and the cold is the beginning of our winter, and maybe it's going to be a truncated and shortened winter, but maybe enough snow will grace the mountain and all the different trails for people to have some fun.
Yeah, we are continually watching the weather, and as soon as Mother Nature sees fit to give us enough snow, we are going to get more terrain open. The good news is it was 31 degrees at the top of the mountain right this afternoon, so hopefully that does mean it's snowing at the top, and that would be good, wet, heavy snow. So we're keeping our fingers crossed. Winter's not over yet, so don't give up on Eagle Crest.
So like many people in town, I have one of those Mark Kelly calendars on my wall, and this month's beautiful picture is of these fantastic fireworks up at Eagle Crest. So tell us about that.
Oh, yes. So every year we have our annual winter fireworks spectacular, and this year it is Saturday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. And so we love snow, and we love Eagle Crest, and we're going to celebrate the snow we have. This is a great community event. We invite the whole community to come on up. The event starts at 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, and we've got some music in the Day Lodge. New thing that we're doing this year, starting at 4:30, from 4:30 to 5:30, is we're having a silent auction of old trail signs. And these are trail signs dating back from the beginning of Eagle Crest time and on up to just a couple of years ago when we replaced the signs. So there's a silent auction. All the proceeds from this auction will go to benefit the Eagle Crest Foundation. So this is a cool way to get a little bit of history of Eagle Crest and come on up and put your bid in.
So all these years of coveting a black diamond sign, I could actually have one in my home or in my yard?
You could.
Out of boundary signs,
closed signs, black diamond, muskeg, Dolly Varden, all of those signs are there for the taking.
And just curious, I mean, history-wise, how far back do these signs go? Is this kind of the recent generation of replacing them? Or?
Recent generations of replacing, but then some of the signs go all the way back to the very early days. So it's pretty cool to see this. We did a small silent auction on Discovery Eagle Crest Day in September, and it was very well received. Mm-hmm. We got rid of several signs, but we still have several more. So this is going to be a great opportunity, again, to get a little history of Eagle Crest and benefit the Eagle Crest Foundation.
And is it just the signs, or are there other historic things that...
This, on Saturday, it's just going to be the signs. Mm-hmm. So they'll be displayed in the mezzanine of the Day Lodge, mm-hmm. and you can start bidding at 4:30, and the bidding will close at 5:30, and then we'll let you know if you want a sign or not. So it's going to be pretty cool.
Are there a lot of them? Or?
There's several.
Yeah.
Okay. There is enough to fill the mezzanine.
Ooh, these will be prizes.
Yeah. You know, and it is pretty cool. And again, it's owning a piece of Eagle Crest. For all of us that are Eagle Crest, it gets in your blood, and it's a passion, and it's kind of cool to think that maybe you could have hang 10 on your wall in your garage or something.
Yeah, I'm thinking my yard.
In your yard. There you go.
Well, anything else regarding Eagle Crest you want people to know about?
Well, and then we're going to do a bonfire on starting at 5 o'clock on the 14th, and then at 6 o'clock is our big winter fireworks spectacular. And this is a great show. It's up close and personal. It's really fun to see the fireworks reflect off the snow and the noise bounce off the mountains. And the 4th of July fireworks crew does a phenomenal job, and they're all volunteers, and we certainly thank all of their efforts in putting on the fireworks show. But this show is completely sponsored by local businesses, and so I just want to give a shout-out to all of these local businesses, because they, without their support, we could not have this great event happen. So it's Shattuck & Grummet, Carson Dorn, NC Machinery, McDowell Group, North Pacific Erectors, Louis Pub, the Westmark Baranoff, Erect Construction, Hangar on the Wharf, the Juno Radio Center, and Alaska Litho. And again, all of these businesses have been real supportive over the years of our winter fireworks, and they've completely sponsored this show. No city money is out of this. It's all business sponsoring the show. So come on up. It's about a 20-minute show. Get up there. You can still have your Valentine's Day evening or go to the Wearable Arts or whatever you're doing on Saturday night.
And I'm curious, I hear the phrase snow dance, you know, encouraging people to do the snow dance. So at an event like this, do you have a big, one giant snow dance? And if so, will you videotape it and put it up on YouTube?
You know, that's a very good question. I don't know if we'll have a big snow dance, but if we do, we will videotape it. Who knows what, you know, there's always this whole saying of you have to burn skis to Uller, and we've got a bonfire going. We've been reluctant to do that. So we didn't want to melt the snow, but, you know, we might just have to start burning some skis in order to get Uller to pay attention to us. But we just invite the whole community to come up. It's going to be a great day up at Eagle Crest on Saturday and a great evening. And you can find more information at skijuno.com.
Jeff Reclow, anything else you wanted to convey to the audience today?
Just, again, that Eagle Crest is opening the Porcupine Chair this weekend. Come on up. Make some turns. Don't give up on Eagle Crest yet. Winter is not over, and we're working hard to get the rest of the mountain open.
Jeffra, thank you very much for coming into the studio today, and good luck with the rest of the season.
Great. Thank you very much.
Let it snow.
Let it snow.
This broadcast, made possible by Alaska Communications, offering home internet and wireless solutions designed to keep Alaskans connected. Because when you live in a place as vast as Alaska, you sometimes need it to feel a little smaller. AlaskaCommunications.com.
Listening to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Wace. I've been happy to be your host this afternoon, and stay tuned. We're coming up on 4 o'clock and All Things Considered coming your way. And don't forget, tomorrow morning, that Tiny Desk Concert winner will be announced on Morning Edition.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast.